You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to a Times Higher Education podcast. This is Tim Savula, the head of content for Times Higher Education's World Summit series, talking from the departure lounge of Jeddah Airport, where we've just completed 3 days of our Times Higher Education Middle East North Africa Summit. I'm joined by Phil Beatty, the editorial director of our global rankings, and Ellie Bothwell, our rankings editor. And we're just going to share some of our highlights and the notable sessions that came out from the summit over the last 3 days here at Jeddah, which was hosted by King Abdulaziz University. The summit featured the launch of our Arab World Rankings for 2018. There were fireworks, there was lots of celebration, and of course lots of questions about the data. Phil, what struck from you in terms of the kinds of questions that you were asked?
I think it's really interesting, actually, that it was such a high profile for the rankings at this summit. You said there was fireworks. There was literally a firework display when we announced that King Abdulaziz was number one in the region, and there was huge celebration there. I think it means a lot to the host university, King Abdulaziz, because it's really a sign of their strengthening internationalization, their strengthening research, and they really are committed, I think, to becoming a global hub. They really are connecting to universities in North America and Europe, as well as other universities in the region. But the pushback, I think, on rankings is, of course, that our current ranking system, the World University Rankings, is very research intensive. It's very much modeled on the more traditional research university, your Stanfords, your Oxfords, your Harvards. And there's a lot of priorities in this region that are focused on education, on closing the skills gap, that sort of thing. So some methodological challenges around how much do you adapt your metrics to suit local circumstances. And I think it's something we're working on. We do want to be able to provide more, a wider range of metrics, a more balanced range of metrics to celebrate and recognize a wider range of university missions.
And some of the keynote speakers we had at the summit included Michael Arthur, the President and Provost of UCL, Feridun Hamdullahpour, the President and Vice Chancellor of the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, and Stacey Lopez, the Associate Vice President at the University of Pennsylvania for Institutional Research and Analysis. And Ellie, you did a story on Feridun's keynote. What struck you particularly from that one?
Yeah, I thought it was a really interesting speech because he was focusing on what makes a kind of top research university for the 21st century, but actually much of what he was talking about was about the way that research kind of applies to students, and the way that research universities actually really need to be focused on kind of providing a good environment for students, which is not something that you necessarily immediately think of about the mission of a university if you're mainly focused on research. And his speech was quite sort of inspiring. He sort of argued about the fact that, you know, it's all very well to have disciplinary excellence, and that, you know, that's a kind of necessary function of a research university, but actually you're only going to survive if you create an environment in which students can imagine and in which they can be creative. And he spoke about various ways in which the University of Waterloo is doing this. So one of which is the way in which students are really exposed to research at the university. They can work on research in their labs. They're really aware of all the work that the scholars at the university are doing in various areas. And another is their really heavy focus on cooperative education. So students in engineering and computer science kind of have to spend some time working in industry, but all other students at the university have an option to do so as well, and they can, I think they can spend about 2 years of about 5 years of their time at university in full-time kind of employment. They alternate between working and studying, and then can apply their research at the university to the working environment as well. So I thought that was a really interesting kind of model an idea of how research universities are now changing still kind of relevant for the years going forward.
I think that actually was a really interesting and somewhat surprising point from our perspective of having organised a summit with King Abdulaziz University and deliberately wanting to have a big focus on research capacity and how to improve research output and quality at the universities. Actually, a lot of the conversations started to naturally go towards teaching and towards student experience and towards how to make students more employable and increase their long-term skills. and particularly, you know, with the challenge of automation and what that might do to the region. I mean, I read a report that had been published in January this year by McKinsey that looked at the region or six countries in the Gulf and found that 45% of all jobs could be affected by automation over the next 10 years. And that's obviously the looking at people who are actually in employment. You know, there's a huge youth bulge in the Gulf region. In Saudi itself, I think it's about 50% of people are under 25, something. Haven't got that statistic in front of me, but it's that kind of number. And so there's not only the issue of people who are in employment, but it's those who are unemployed already and what's going to happen. So it's really, really crucial for universities to be able to work out how they can support the governments, really, and ensure that, you know, people can get the skills that they need and the jobs that they want and have stability and prosperity in that region, which obviously has a big knock-on effect to the rest of the world. And the challenge of that skills gap was neatly raised by the Vice President for Microsoft Arabia, Mamdou Najjar, who talked about how students had to become more employable in order for the big technology companies to keep on investing. He also made the point that he said that data was a new currency, and the way that universities could capture more data about student learning and student outcomes was crucial for them in terms of how they could develop and offer and increase their reputation for teaching as well as research. And I noticed that Stacey Lopez, the head of institutional research for Penn, she made a nice analogy that she'd heard that, you know, if data was a new currency in the region, she could describe it as data being oil and the role of IR as being like the refinery that could turn that oil into actually something that people could use on a practical basis. Phil, what was your perspective of listening to Stacey's presentation and hearing about the role of Penn, one of the world's best universities, and how that might correspond and the kind of context it could offer to university researchers here in MENA?
I mean, I think it was a fantastic presentation, actually. It was really lively. It was one of the final sessions of the day. She was fantastic. The thing that really struck me was just how extraordinary the data capacity is at a place like Penn. It's world top 10. She has 9 full-time data analysts on her team. They have this massive data warehouse of extraordinary complexity. It's brilliant. And I think it really does highlight how important it is for universities to harness data better and use data better. There's a lot of evidence in this region that universities aren't collecting much institutional data. They're certainly not willing to share it, and that's a real issue.
And Ellie, were there any other highlights from you?
Yeah, I thought the panel on building successful research strategies was really interesting. In particular, the Koch University rector, Imran Inan, I thought raised some really interesting points about Turkey, which I think, you know, a lot of the region can learn from in terms of, you know, obviously it's a country that's had quite a lot of instability in the last couple of years in terms of the failed military coup. And he spoke about the fact that actually he was really concerned that this would cause a big problem for the university in terms of recruiting talent, in particular foreign academics. But actually he found that, you know, there were some really, really strong applications from international scholars who were still really keen to work in the country. And he thought the reason was because they were drawn to the country and that region because they felt that it would actually be a much more challenging environment where their research would make a massive impact. And I spoke to him about this afterwards, and he said, you know, in places like the US and in other parts of Europe, you can, you know, maybe... His analogy was sort of like, you know, you can lift your finger and nothing really happens, and if you do the same in Turkey, actually, you know, huge things happen, and it can have a massive impact on the economy and on students and the public in the region. I mean, he said that he thought that the MENA region as a whole could be inspired, I guess, by this idea and create PhD scholarships for foreign students that want to come to the region and also, you know, want a challenging environment and to make an impact, because, you know, he said that recruiting PhD students is one of the biggest challenges that they face. You know, that they're really the ones that kind of build up the knowledge economy in the region. And he thought that, you know, this was maybe actually a way in which places like Turkey and Saudi Arabia and others can actually compete with some of the top universities in the world, you know, even places like Stanford.
We also had a conversation at the summit about the role of English as a medium of instruction that you chaired, Phil, and that came quite lively towards the end. with several people making passionate points about, you know, the role of universities as a whole and how the language that they taught reflects, you know, the kind of the culture that they can promote and inculcate with their students. Phil, what were your sort of thoughts from the end of that session?
I think it's a really challenging issue actually for myself as a wrangler. There's a lot of concern about the role of or the dominance of English language in a global higher education. It's the medium of instruction in so many cases now. You know, you're looking at continental European universities teaching in English in order to attract international students, particularly from East Asia. You're looking at English as the language of publication. Of course, it's the language of business as well. And I feel quite strongly that we need to unite around a common language. We need to be able to share our ideas, share new research, share innovations across the world. And you need a common language to do it, and that is English. And I think it's a really positive force. It's enabling universities to internationalize. It's enabling cultures to come together and staff and students to move around the world. But there is this real sensitivity around giving up your culture. I think it's linked to this idea that rankings have the risk of homogenizing universities, a risk of pushing institutions in a certain direction that might be contrary to national priorities or regional priorities. So it was a really passionate debate, and I think the upshot was that, you know, universities need to protect what makes them special. They need to protect local language, local culture, and rankings need to try and reflect that a bit better. And I think we try, you know, we do surveys of academics in 14 different languages. We do a lot of work to normalize the citations to reflect a different national citation volume. So we're working hard at that. And of course, by going into regions and doing regional analyses and regional data cuts, we then, allow a spotlight to be shined on institutions here in their own context.
In that session as well, I thought Mikael Gazella raised some... He's from the Humboldt University of Berlin and does research on language, and he raised some interesting points about the idea of universities in Europe. You know, there's been a huge expansion in English language degrees and how, you know, that's been really good at attracting international students. But actually, you know, one of the problems that some of these countries have is retaining those students and keeping the skills in the country afterwards. And in his kind of solution for that was about creating what he called multilingual universities. So, you know, universities where when you graduate, you would kind of, you know, there'd be kind of some kind of requirement for you to be bilingual afterwards, or, you know, make sure you actually really learn the language of the country you're in, because otherwise, you know, there are these people who, international students who come and study in these universities and then actually can't get a job in the local region afterwards, and the talent kind of falls away again.
There was a really interesting flip side as well, wasn't there, that the sense that actually the North American, the Australian, the British students potentially could end up being disadvantaged because they're so less international in their focus. They don't learn other languages. They're not exposed to thinking and learning and even dreaming, as someone said, in a different language. And that potentially limits them educationally, limits them, their experiences, and potentially holds them back in the future when other languages become more important. You know, Spanish is rising and Arabic, etc., etc., and Mandarin, of course.
Well, that's quite a neat segue, in fact, towards our next summit, which is taking place in Europe, in New Europe. It's the Research Excellence Summit that will be hosted by Palackey University in the Czech Republic, taking place in the end of April. So as our flight comes up on the board here in Jeddah Airport, it's probably time for us to say goodbye and look out for the stories that Ellie's been writing up. Will be published in Times Higher Education, our magazine, and on our website. And as we said, our next summit will take place in the Czech Republic at the end of April. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.